This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Mary Martin Devlin about The La Motte Woman, the second of her novels set in pre-revolutionary France. We all know the clichés of the French Revolution, Marie-Antoinette saying, "Let the meat cake," the storming of the Bastille, entire aristocratic families sent to the guillotine. Where Devlin excels is in revealing the extravagance and obliviousness and sheer bad luck that drove those outside the ancient noblesse d'épée first to despair and then to violence. But at the very beginning of The La Motte Woman, there are still grounds for hope. The two girls, their arms encircling heavy gutter pipes, dangle precariously from the attic window of a fashionable dressmaker's workroom in the Palais Royal. For over an hour, they had been waiting for the fanfare that would announce the passage of the royal carriages with the Dauphin and his bride, the Austrian Archduchess Marie Antoinette. The newlyweds would proceed down the Rue de Rivoli, past the Tuileries, to the Place Louis XV, where the day's festivities would begin. It was a bright spring day in 1770, and Paris was in a delirium of joy. By night, the city was a fairyland with lanterns strung along the rooftops, around windows, across streets. Notre Dame Cathedral shimmered, a gauzy, glittering phantasm on the Seine. Fountains in every square overflowed with red and white wine. Loaves of bread lay so thick on the streets that even the poor did not bother to stoop and pick them up. France was alive with hope. Louis Auguste the Dauphin was 16 years old, pious, frugal, and reserved. Marie Antoinette, 15. A golden child glowing with innocence, and these two, when they reached the throne, would surely right the wrongs and cure the miseries of the reign of the Dauphin's grandfather, the pleasure-besotted Louis XV. "They aren't coming, Jeanne," one of the girls said, shrilling above the babble of the crowd in the street below. "It's gone 10 o'clock." She looked leaden with disappointment. And now, please join me in welcoming Mary Martin Devlin. Mary, I look forward to talking with you today.
And I with you, Carolyn. Let's go.
You spent much of your career as a professor of English and creative writing at Mount Holyoke College. How did you branch out from that to writing historical fiction, especially fiction set in 18th century France?
Actually, I did my undergraduate degree in French literature, went on to do a master's in French with a minor in English, and then went to France with a Fulbright scholarship. But when it came to doing my PhD, I think because I had done my minor, my thesis on the MA in French, I decided to do my PhD in English. I again did another master's in English and then the doctorate in English. And as for writing historical fiction, I think because I grew up loving historical fiction. You know, I was learning and being entertained and at the same time, and it was my favorite genre and still is. If with my preferences, I want to read history or historical fiction, even though my specialty was the American novel at Mount Holyoke.
Although I noticed you also have a book set in 1980s Zaire called Death and the Rainy Season. Whatever our kids think, that's not historical fiction yet. Can you give us a brief summary of that book and how you came to write it?
Yes, indeed, it is not historical fiction. I suppose you would, you know, place it as mainstream fiction. And here I probably ought to pause to give a little bit of personal background so that you understand where that novel came from. I was teaching, I was a Fulbright professor at the University of Tunis, and I got an urgent call from Paris, from USIA, the U.S. Information Agency, which is the cultural branch of the State Department. They had had a dropout with a sub-Saharan lecturer in French, and they were desperate to fill it and called me to see whether I would go down. And since we were at the university approaching spring break, I did go down for this Francophone Africa, sub-Saharan Africa tour, and much to my surprise, it was a real success. And so that for several years thereafter, when Mount Holyoke was on winter term in January, I would leave snowy New England and go down to Africa to lecture. And during that period, I met and later married the legendary CIA officer, Larry Devlin. And this is going to sound borderline insane, but I resigned from Mount Holyoke as a full professor with tenure and went off to live in Africa. And that period of living in Africa, where because of Larry's situation, I was able to really to mingle or be involved with so many layers of the society out there, so that when I came back to Washington, I really, really wanted to preserve all the memories of the characters I had known there, although the novel is truly not autobiographical except for the purely African experiences that I had, which I give, and the characters are all composites of people I had met through the years.
It's really fascinating. Your first French novel, Precious Pawn, is set in the 1740s and 1750s. It follows the tragic story of Diane de Fautrière. Tell us about the memoir that sparked this novel.
The memoir, unpublished memoir, was used by one of my closest friends and colleagues at Mount Holyoke in the French department in her translation and stylistics course. And she asked me to double-check her translation, not being a native speaker, of the memoir. And ever after that, I don't know, that story haunted me of this young girl, this child, really, who, 14 or 15, was taken to Paris, to the court of Louis the 15th, probably the most debauched place in the entire universe, and groomed his beautiful, extraordinarily beautiful daughter to make a brilliant, brilliant marriage.
So how did you turn that memoir into a novel? I mean, your novel's much longer, obviously, and more filled in, and you have translations as epigraphs throughout the chapters. But did you also expand it, adapt it, change it in some way?
It's really largely expanded, especially with the characters, because in writing, I don't know about you, but I invest so much thought and imagination in creating characters. But the novel does follow the tragic narrative arc of the young Diane de Fautrière, and in the scenes, now, as far as her father's plans for her, they went way beyond his expectations, because she caught the eye of Louis XV himself, and there was a prolonged flirtation of him, during which she almost became his official mistress. But she was set aside for Madame de Pompadour, who was, of course, much, much more experienced, was older, more experienced, and from the time she was a child, fortune tellers had predicted that she would be the wife of the king. So she had her obsession in mind. But the scenes in which she first meets Louis XV, and all the scenes during her flirtation with him, or his flirtation with her, it would be more exact, that is taken really almost word for word from the memoir. But as you say, the memoir is quite slight, but I kept the frame, the narrative frame, but all of the characters, and I added only one key character to her life, and that is Armand, who becomes her lover, because I wanted that poor child to have at least some joy in her life.
So before we move on to the La Motte woman, could you expand a little bit on your description of the court of Louis XV at Versailles and the general atmosphere of aristocratic society at that time? Because it does act as a backdrop to the new novel.
Well, as I mentioned before, with Louis XV, it was a pleasure-driven place. Utterly pleasure-driven, dissipated, debauched, and so forth. Louis XIV, who was a bit of a pious prig at times, had almost a diabolical scheme of creating Versailles, this enormous palace, to bring his aristocratic rivals under his roof so that they would do what he thought they would do, which is they would backstab each other to garner his favor and fight each other over honors and so forth, so that the aristocracy really was weakened. They were like Diane's father. They neglected their estates and they became impoverished. And by the time Louis XV ascended to the throne, it was really a peacock parade every day. Men and women were very similar in dress and behavior. The men wore heavy makeup. They wore wigs. They wore satins and lace and stockings and high heels. And they had it was referred to as Sipaisi, the other country. And they had their own little mannerisms and behaviors. For instance, they did not knock at a door. They scratched at a door. And the women had, I have a hard time visualizing this, but they didn't really step. They had a kind of slide or glide to their walk. It was really not the place that you would want to bring your extraordinarily beautiful young daughter.
No, especially not at 14, which I think is what she was when she got there. Barely 14, as I recall. So let's move on now. I won't ask you my usual question about what drew you to the story of the Diamond Necklace Affair, because it's a story that's so tailor-made for fiction, I can't imagine any novelist not being drawn to it. But how did you find out about it?
Well, you know, it is such a major turning point in French history. And, you know, starting with Alexandre Dumas, you know, the French have been at it writing novels and plays and so forth about it. So and you get fascinated by, and I can remember being my first notice of Jeanne de la Mode, of the Lamotte woman, was in reading Thackeray's Vanity Fair with Becky Sharp, and reading that Becky Sharp was inspired by Jeanne de la Mode. And I thought that was, I loved Becky Sharp, that little vixen, but it inspired me to look further into the possibilities with the Lamotte movement a long, long time ago.
So sketch the background for us, please. What's going on in France in 1770? What does the populace hope that the Dauphin and his bride can correct?
Well, they, Marie Antoinette, and a lot of, the condemnation of her, I think, is a bit misplaced, because she was just a teenager when she came to France, and she was frivolous and reckless and teenagery. I think that film, Marie Antoinette, of Kirsten Dunst, just really did portray Marie Antoinette as she actually was. But there was so much hope after the darkness, that because Louis XV, who had started out as such a beloved king, absolutely worshipped by his people. He turned into a bloated old sex addict, no interest in government. It was Madame de Pompadour who actually ran the country, appointing ambassadors and so forth. So the wedding of Louis XVI with Marie Antoinette was a joyous occasion, but I must say the bloom was very quickly off the rose for Marie Antoinette. She, Louis could not perform his marital duties for 7 solid years. She was just having a good time and spending money hand over fist, and particularly diamonds. I should have said, that the story of Jeanne de la Mode is ready-made for fiction, but I started out telling it with 3 different narrators, Jeanne, the Cardinal, and Bagneau. Because I thought, it'd be nice to have something like a Rashomon development, where the reader will be able to make up his own mind or her own mind about whether this narrator is reliable or unreliable. And because each one of those 3 is so distinguished in language, et cetera, it really just rolled along. The writing, it was a pleasure every single morning to sit down at my computer and go at it. And then I got to one of the later scenes, and it is a scene, and I could not figure out, it was impossible that any one of the 3 narrators describe that scene. Impossible. I had to have a witness, and I couldn't figure out any plausible witness for what happened. So I had to start all over again and rewrite the novel as an omniscient, from the omniscient point of view, and particularly the limited third person point of view.
That's really interesting. We could talk for the rest of the time about that, because those are big questions, how that affects a particular story. But I'm glad to know that. That's really, I'm sure it was helpful nonetheless to have done all that work telling the story from the different points of view. They are very distinct personalities, and you can see that.
Yeah, it was. It was a tremendous step forward, really. I still wish I could have finished the novel with those 3. But you do get the voice in the novel with the epilogue, which belongs to Bagneau, the survivor. You do get his voice, and you can understand more of his character through that epilogue to the novel.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
So let's start with Jeanne de Saint-Rémy, which is how she's known when she first appears. She's just about as different in personality as anyone could be from Diane de Fautrière. But who is Jeanne in terms of her birth and her place in Parisian society?
Well, in point of fact, she was actually what she claimed to be. She was a descendant of the royal blood of King Henry II, the Valois king, and her grandfather was the legitimized, not legitimate, you know, but legitimized son of Henry II. And her father was this Baron, the Baron de Saint-Rémy. So she was actually born, unlike the false Countess title that she assumed later in life, she was actually a princess of the royal blood, but it was no longer the Valois kings who reigned France. But her father was a typical aristocrat who neglected everything, and she was born into utmost poverty. She was a beggar on the streets of Paris. Her mother was a prostitute who ran, after the father died, she ran off with a soldier, left the two children she left behind, the brother and Jeanne, and Marianne, the little baby, was left with a farmer back in their hometown. The mother very generously left the two children a big bag of chestnuts, but that was all. And Jeanne was a beggar. She would go into taverns and inns and tell her story of being a royal princess and et cetera, et cetera. And she would also hitch a ride, step up on the side of carriages of the aristocrats going to their country places from Paris. And she was, as luck would have it, she hitched onto the carriage of a couple who were massively important in Paris, and the Marquise de Boulainvilliers, who was she was a fan of genealogy, and she thought, well, wouldn't this be something to talk about if this little urchin, dirty as she is, and her claims proved to be true. So she took the children in, all three of them, raised them, educated them, et cetera, and worked years and years and years to get the official genealogist of Louis the 16th to recognize Jeanne's claim. And Jeanne and her brother and her sister were given royal pensions, which should have satisfied Jeanne for the rest of life. But of course, it didn't.
That's the understatement of the world. Yes, from the beginning, we see Jeanne has what we might call a flexible relationship with the truth. So how would you characterize her personality?
Oh, my goodness. Where to start? She was not, you know, she had a powerful influence on men. I mean, she was quite a magnet for men. But she was not your typical femme fatale. She didn't have that dark, mysterious side. She was more the wild side, you know, gay. You would never be bored with her, charming. And the truth was not something that she thought she had to indulge in unless absolutely necessary, like Becky Sharp or Becky Sharp like her. She was opportunist. She had no qualms about dedicating her high baroque sex life to her ambition. She was clever and manipulative, but she also must have been endowed with a tremendous charm.
Yeah, she is very much like Becky Sharper. I'm impressed that that's an actual literal, you know, it's an intended connection, because when I was reading the book, I thought, my goodness, she's a lot like Becky Sharper. And of course, Becky Sharper is tremendously appealing. Maybe not if you have to deal with her in everyday life, but to read about, I mean, people like this are wonderful.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So part of her appeal is that she is the quintessential survivor. She always lands on her feet. And how, for example, does she go from being Jeanne de Saint-Rémy to Jeanne de la Motte?
She and her sister, and this is a little bit complicated to go into, but they ended up back in their hometown, Bar-sur-Aube, where their Chateau Fontaine. She always came back to me. She wanted to impress everybody that she had, who had known her as a little beggar, and of the Baron de Saint-Rémy. She wanted to impress them, and she ended up there. And she and her sister ended up in what they thought was an inn, but it actually was a brothel, and they were rescued by the young Beugnot, the son of a bourgeois, a very well-to-do bourgeois family. And Beugnot, of course, was immediately smitten with Jeanne. That was his first love, and he helped get her and her sister established in a minor aristocratic, well-to-do household there in Bar. And during that time, and it was a couple of years, she got into really serious trouble with the baron, with the Bishop de Langres, and had to get married. And the Bishop de Langres negotiated a marriage with Nicholas de la Motte, who was a feckless ne'er-do-well grenadier in an obscure regiment. And it was not a love match, to be sure, but it was one of those go-along, get-along marriages where his gifts with pawn shops and so forth suited her. She always provided the money in the marriage, and he was very compliant with her with her conduct, as she was with his gambling and so forth.
Yeah, she has many lovers, most of them after her marriage, as was quite characteristic of 18th century European aristocratic marriages. But I'm glad you brought up Beugnot, because I really wanted to talk about him a little bit. But also, the most important relationship, perhaps, at least in terms of the diamond necklace affair, is the her love affair with the Cardinal Prince Louis de Rohan, who, despite his high ecclesiastical office, has no inhibitions about taking a mistress. So how does she meet him, and what can you tell us about him and their relationship?
She met the Cardinal Prince through the Marquise de Boulainvilliers, and it was almost an immediate connection. He's a complex character. He was extraordinarily handsome. He was known as the Adonis of the church, and Jeanne was certainly not his first conquest, if you can call it that. I don't know the church well enough to know at what time the church decided that sexual relationships were inappropriate for men of the cloth, but it certainly was not true of the 18th century. I mean, there was the Bishop de Langres, and before the Cardinal Prince, with Jeanne, at least. And towards the end of the novel, Jeanne stops for dinner at an abbey, and the abbot and monks receive her with, you know, great courtesy, because, as Beugnot says, she was a princess of the church. They considered her a princess of the church. That's kind of how twisted things can get. The cardinal The story of the Lamotte woman, it's a story of three obsessions. There was Jeanne's obsession with her royal blood. There was the cardinal's obsession with becoming prime minister of France, and especially gaining the favor of Marie Antoinette. And the third was the obsession of those stubborn, bullheaded crown jewelers who had this extravagant necklace on their hands that was driving them into bankruptcy, yet they refused to break up the stones and sell it to, they wanted to sell that necklace to Marie Antoinette. So the cardinal, even though he was the youngest member of the, he was not only handsome, but he was extremely intelligent. And he was the youngest member ever admitted to the Académie Française, the youngest. And yet, Jeanne had him eating out of her hands every step of the way. She extracted enormous sums of money from him without his ever knowing where that money was really going. It was really quite something in that regard.
Yeah, she was, and he genuinely loves her, at least in your novel. Even after he's well aware of what she's done to him, he continues to love her.
That's right. That's right. In all those terrible scenes where he's confronted with her, after he knows that he is where he is, that she is, as he says, so many of these words. There are so many memoirs of this. This is the most well-documented historical event I can think of. But with all these memoirs, I even am able to quote verbatim their words. He had enormous tenderness for her in their confrontations after he knew that, as he said, she had ripped his life, his fortune, everything to pieces. He still wanted to take care of her. He still he didn't want anything, any harm to come to her. Knowing what she had done and how, it's very hard to understand, really. It's very, very hard to understand. And Bugnot, when he, in his memoirs, when he talks about finding and reading just a few of the love letters of the cardinal to Jeanne, he was absolutely stunned because he had never, ever thought that any man could be so possessed of this raw, fierce passion, because as Bugnot would say, he was an emotionally economical person, and he was a level-headed lawyer and a bourgeois, and he stayed that way even through the years of his great eminence.
Yes, and that's an example of how distinctive they are as a trio. So even with milking the cardinal for all he's worth, Jeanne is still not satisfied, which gets in part to your comment that she's obsessed, and in part to the earlier comment that she, despite having been acknowledged and given the pension and so on, she just can't let go. And so this brings us to the diamond necklace affair itself. Now, I don't know how much you want to say to the audience. This is really up to you. I have to say, watching her work is a good part of the fun of the novel, because you figure out pretty quickly what is true and what's not true. But do describe the necklace itself, and then tell us whatever you want us to know about this.
I cannot imagine any woman, particularly any woman that is slim and whatever, wearing that necklace. It's worth, going to Wikipedia and getting a picture of it, because there are many, many pictures of this necklace. And it kind of amused me with this French series Lupin, where they play kind of a spoof on the Queen's necklace, because what is presented is this a small little piece of jewelry, whereas the real necklace was 650 diamonds. some of them as large as hazelnuts. It was almost 3,000 carats. It was enormous. It was huge. The presentation case was the size of a welcome mat. And the tassels, the stream of diamonds descended. It was called the La Riviere. The jewelers invented that term. And the stream of diamonds descended all the way to the navel. And the necklace was designed by Basinge. Burma was the salesman. They were the crown jewelers, really, of every court in Europe. And they had designed the necklace with Madame du Barry, who was the last mistress of Louis the 15th. They had designed it for her, because they knew very well that the sex-addled king would pay for it, and it was a price in the gazillions that would bankrupt a nation. No other. It was peddled all over Europe, and no other kingdom would buy it because it would have bankrupted the whole nation. But Louis up and dies, and therefore Madame du Barry was no longer at court. She was pretty much exiled. And they were stuck with this necklace.
From a historical perspective now, rather than that of your novel, why did Napoleon say that the death of Queen Marie Antoinette was the result of the diamond necklace affair?
I think because Marie Antoinette had had been so reckless that her reputation had been in tatters. But the diamond necklace affair galvanized all of Europe. I mean, it was, as we would call it today, that trial was a media frenzy. And that brought her name over. She became the central figure in that trial. Did she know? Did she participate? Was she involved? That is still, in history, an ambiguous question, simply because of how the king and Marie Antoinette behaved after the diamond necklace trial. But the way she was vilified in the streets of Paris, in every possible way, in drawings, these pornographic drawings of her German vice, which was lesbianism. There were dirty songs sung under the windows of just about everybody in Paris. It was just a horrible. Her reputation, she was thrown into the gutter. From that time on, she became known as the Austrian whore, and Austria having been forever a traditional enemy of the French. And her death sentence really, I think Napoleon meant that there was no redeeming characteristics. She was not to be redeemed whatsoever. And Mirabeau, the great statesman, said the diamond necklace affair was the prelude to the French Revolution, which indeed it really was.
Yes, and you can see why it would be, frankly. I mean, just what you say about the expense of the necklace, the fact that it was even considered would have been enough to awaken people to the idea that their government might not have had their best interests at heart, let's put it that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what would you like people to take away from the La Motte woman?
Gosh, it's such a rich story, isn't it? Well, I suppose... I don't know. I'm fond of irony, so I would say one ironic aspect to the whole novel is that one woman in an age where women had virtually no value and sometimes a nice racehorse was superior to that woman. I would say it's such an irony that this woman was so instrumental in propelling the destruction of the entire monarchy. The second would be, and I think much more important, this woman who valued her royal blood more than anything else in her life, that was the driving force in her life, her notion of all of the wealth and accoutrements that go with being royal, that she should be so instrumental in destroying the monarchy itself, that seems to me such an ironic twist to the whole matter, that she, after all of her writings, everything that was really like so much poison, drip, 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 after the trial.
Well, that's certainly a very good point. This book came out last month. Are you already working on something new?
I'm browsing, and I just love I love the possibilities of the internet, where you can, go on the Bibliothèque Nationale and, the Memoir of Bugnot, and, it's free. You download it in about 2 minutes, and you just have a wealth of material to at your fingertips with the internet. I remember going to the old Bibliothèque Nationale, where it was located in the heart of Paris, and getting the first photocopy of the unpublished memoir of the Comtesse de L, and it took, I had to make my request one day, come back and pick up the photocopy the next day. And it cost, I think, as I recall, it was over $100. And whereas now you have so much free information right at your fingertips. So I'm browsing now. I'm browsing.
Okay. Well, keep me posted on what you settle on, and maybe we can talk again someday. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
I've really enjoyed it, Carolyn. I really have enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Mary Martin Devlin about the La Motte woman. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Histfic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at www.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.